Hyperion to a Saturn.
Welcome to the 13th episode of Hyperion to a Satyr, the Fire and Water Podcast Network's Hamlet podcast. I'm your host, Siskoid, your guide on a scene-by-scene deep-dive look at Shakespeare's masterwork through the lens of not only the text, but many film, television, comics, and music adaptations. Today we continue Act 2, Scene 2 with Brevity. Well, the conversation in which Polonius promises he'll be brief to the king and queen, at any rate. What to be or not to be is to Hamlet, this speech is to Polonius, and crucially, it represents the conspiratorial beginnings of a thread that will lead to Polonius' own demise. That Polonius is wrong about the cause of Hamlet's madness goes without saying, but in and of itself does not constitute wrongdoing. Polonius' sin is that he feels the need to prove his theory by covert means. Just as he sent a spy to his son, so will he use his daughter to help him spy on Hamlet. In classical tragedy, hubris is the flaw that leads to a character's doom. In Polonius's case, hubris is definitely in play. He even offers to have his head cut off if he's proven wrong, which one would never do unless possessed by arrogant self-confidence. So let us look at the text a little more closely. Polonius says, "My liege, and madam, to expostulate what majesty should be, what duty is, why day is day, night, night, and time is time, were nothing but to waste night, day, and time. Therefore, since brevity is the soul of wit, and tediousness the limbs and outward flourishes, I will be brief. Your noble son is mad. Mad call I it, for, to define true madness, what is't but to be nothing else but mad? But let that go." So there are several ironies embedded in Polonius' words, and not just the ones he puts there himself. Polonius, of course, does not realize that he's being tedious, even in proclaiming brevity. Shakespeare's own ironic streak is also at play. He knows that his play is overlong, and that in a sense, it attempts to contain the whole of the world. Hamlet himself will go on at length about various subjects, including mortality, theater, and humanity, almost reveling in his intellect's ability to apprehend all things. Shakespeare wastes time, knows it, and mocks it. Polonius also claims that madness cannot be defined, which the play also fails to do in Hamlet's case. There is no doubt that Ophelia goes mad, but does her prince? Shakespeare never overtly tells us. Hamlet is said to be mad, and so that must be true for the characters who believe it to be true. In fiction, some things must be taken at face value, or not at all, like the madness central to the intrigue. "More matter with less art," says Gertrude. Well, you'll note that Claudius defers to her in this conversation, again pointing to the idea that it's principally part of her agenda. While Claudius lets Polonius ramble, she's far less patient with him. In a way, this fuels the competition between Polonius and Gertrude, as the former's theory contradicts the latter's. Does Polonius feel the need to prove himself exactly because he gets opposition from the king's other great advisor? Polonius replies, "Madam, I swear I use no art at all. That he is mad, tis true, tis pity, and pity tis true, a foolish figure, but farewell it, for I will use no art." Well, this is more dramatic irony. Polonius cannot help but use art to say he will use none. So he tells them the madness comes from love denied, and uses a love poem from Hamlet to Ophelia as proof. It'll be interesting to compare how Hamlet's letter is used by different directors. In the text, it is read by Polonius, but different film versions have allowed others to read it, or have played with the idea that Polonius has taken it, not been given it. The detail changes how we perceive both Polonius and Ophelia. Note also the use of beautified in the poem, and compare it to the later line about God giving women one face and their making themselves another. That's one of Shakespeare's frequent rails against vanity. Why is Shakespeare drawing our attention to this word by making Polonius snag onto it? Should we see sarcasm in Hamlet's poem? And would that not indicate that it was actually written after he set his plan in motion? If actually written before his father's death, the letter would represent one of the few glimpses into the happy life of Hamlet before the momentous events of the play. So, who was he before his father died, or at least before he learned his father was murdered? The play's timeline being what it is, which is to say, vague, the letter could still have been written after some of these events, changing its meaning. If written much later, it could seem like a testament to his love for Ophelia, no matter what he later says, though she may not have understood the message. His actions after Act 1 are to call everything into doubt, because he's been lied to by his uncle. What else is a lie? The play on the word doubt here is crucial.
Doubt thou the stars are fire? Doubt the sun doth move? Doubt truth to be a liar? But never doubt I love.
There is also more than a little fatalism in the last two lines. Thine evermore, most dear lady, whilst this machine is to him, Hamlet. Could this letter have been left for her during his final visit to her closet? And is it thus coded with the things he dares not say out loud? Polonius then tells the royals he was the one who put a stop to the love affair, which is another example of Polonius trying to save face by proudly claiming that he saw what was going on between Hamlet and Ophelia before he was told of it. The player queen is not the only character who protests too much. Polonius is obsessed with not being perceived as a foolish old man. His foolishness is not in his blindness, but in his misinterpretation of other characters' intentions. Or, my dear majesty, your queen here think, if I had played the desk or table book, or given my heart a winking, mute and dumb, or looked upon this love with idle sight, what might you think? No, I went round to work. An odd contradiction here, as Polonius supposes the queen would have disapproved of the Hamlet-Ophelia match, and she doesn't correct him. Yet, after Ophelia's death, she says she expected them to marry with her blessing. This scene puts the lie to her later words, though the impropriety may be lost to modern eyes, i.e., the match was not the problem, only that the wooing was conducted outside official channels and permissions. Polonius goes on. A short tale to make, he says, but this tale has been anything but short. The royals question it, but Polonius doubles down. Hath there been such a time that I have positively said 'tis so when it proved otherwise? To which Claudius replies, not that I know. Well, one of the king's most foolhardy traits is his blind trust in Polonius, who in fact is proven wrong on almost every point during the play. It's also a reminder of how briefly he's been king. Despite having lusted after the throne, he doesn't have years of experience. He really doesn't know. We might question, how did Polonius act with Hamlet Sr.? Did the old king give him this long a leash? Despite his flaws, was he the most trusted advisor to Hamlet Sr.? Maybe old Hamlet knew how to get Polonius to the point more promptly, or was Polonius even as prominent in the Hamlet administration as he is here? All of his lectures to his children on status and propriety do sound like someone who just climbed to a new position and is desperately afraid of being embarrassed. Now, personally, my interpretation has always been that Polonius is Claudius's man and was nowhere near as prominent in Hamlet Sr.'s court. But then, if he wasn't prime minister, who was? The only answer I can think of is, well, Claudius himself. Brother to the king and running things while he's out to the wars, and eventually falls for the queen and wants to run the show himself. The text doesn't say. If I tend to assume Polonius climbed up the ladder with Claudius, it's because there are hints. Polonius is a political animal and would have seen the wind turn and gone along with it. Claudius seems very close to Polonius's family, treats Laertes like a son and so on. Hamlet never treats Polonius as a traitor the way he does his mother. And maybe Claudius feels beholden to Polonius because he helped him grease the wheels with the court after the coup. In any case, Shakespeare laces the play with insinuations that the current regime is not fit to rule in various ways. One of these is overt comparisons to common professions, such as farming. When Polonius says that if he turns out to be wrong, let me be no assistant for a state, but keep a farm and carters. And there are later comparisons to fishmongers and beggars. At the end of the sequence, they make a plan to hide behind an heiress after sending Ophelia in Hamlet's path, and the royals rush out when they see Hamlet coming their way with a book in his hands, and Polonius goes over to board him. Now, in the Branna version, as Polonius starts on his brief speech, the king and queen are signing papers, presumably. the Norwegian treaty, which is an interesting touch. The queen, in Branagh's version, is more definitely involved in governing the kingdom, partnering with Claudius in affairs of state. She's not an object to be lusted after, but necessary to the stability of Denmark. This small detail gives her character greater power and really stands in opposition to Ophelia's servile role. Richard Briers' performance as Polonius is likewise noteworthy. His take on the character is more sinister and less bumbling. He speaks the words with a quick rhythm, in definite earnest. Yes, Gertrude finds him pedantic and tries to rush him, but he's not so long-winded as to be comical. There is no hesitation, no distractedness, no sense that he is reveling in his own wit. This is just how he speaks and thinks, and he will take you through his thought process because he feels it is necessary to your understanding. There's that hubris. And in fact, Gertrude is convinced by the argument. Of course, that may also have something to do with the use of Ophelia in this scene. Branagh creates a moment that isn't in the text by having Polonius bring in his daughter to read Hamlet's letter. So there's no question she spilled the beans. She does so only haltingly, breaking up after almost every word.
To the celestial and my soul's idol, the most beautified Ophelia.
Between her reading and the reactions of the listeners, the overwhelming feeling is that of embarrassment. Ophelia is being exposed here, and her father's voice touchingly quivers in sympathy, though he is the monster who forces her to metaphorically disrobe before the royals. His gorge is rising at the vile words. By the time she hits white bosom, she runs off humiliated. Polonius continues, but we're sent into a flashback that features post-coital Hamlet and Ophelia in bed when the poem was apparently composed. The reading gives way to Hamlet's own voice until we return to Polonius for the signature. This flashback has a number of implications. First, Branagh chooses to make the letter genuine. It is an artifact from a happier time and is not part of a ploy to deceive Claudius. Second is the rather libidinous turn that the word groans takes. Hamlet is no stranger to vulgar double entendres, as per the prelude to the play within the play, for example, and at the end of lovemaking, he is naughty in his wordplay. Gertrude may be convinced more by Ophelia's behavior than Polonius's words. After all, she too has recently done things in the name of love and would believe in such a force. Another bit of nice wordplay, Ophelia is Polonius's daughter while she is his, but Hamlet is hers while his machine, his body, is his own. Shakespeare plays with the possessive in this section in a way that begs to be examined. Polonius may logically think that Hamlet is his because he claims to belong to his daughter or property. He'll get him, he'll get at his mystery. However, the question of the play is whether Hamlet is still in control of his faculties. Is his machine still his? And if not, then his heart no longer belongs to Ophelia, but rather to his madness, revenge, father. Polonius assumes wrongly once again. In Olivier, the scene starts on the king and queen looking into each other's eyes, hiding the figure of Polonius, showing how focused they are on each other compared to other things. As Polonius starts to speak, they separate and we see him between their heads, a shot reprised a number of times during this section. Olivier's staging is usually very deliberate, so we can infer that Polonius is creating an impediment to their couplehood. He separates them by bringing news of Hamlet, opening a can of worms that the royal couple was not necessarily willing to open. Remember, in this version, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern do not exist, so the royals are here triggered into addressing the Hamlet situation. They're not proactively recruiting agents. Polonius imposes this agenda on them, which will lead to the couple's undoing, as prefigured in the staging here. Claudius, in fact, couldn't look less compassionate. He's stern and aloof, frequently looking at Gertrude's reactions for cues. While Gertrude does prod Polonius for more direct answers, Claudius isn't any more patient with his well-meaning but tedious aid. When he says, "Not that I know of," there is an underlying sense of mistrust.
"Hath there been such a time I'd fain know that I have positively said 'tis so that it proved otherwise?"
"Not that I know." It's not that Polonius hasn't been a useful counselor, but that he's meddling in things the king might not want to be bothered with.
He's only letting Polonius talk to keep the queen happy. Gertrude, for her part, seems to have given up hope.
More matter with less art.
There's despair in her voice when she asks for more matter, as if to tell Polonius that this is too serious a subject for him to play with words. Based on that reaction, the king agrees to some token spying. Olivier has Hamlet overhear the whole thing, which will have to be taken into account when discussing his meeting with Ophelia later. He will already know it's a setup. On matters related to the letter, in this version, we must accept that Ophelia went to her father and surrendered her correspondence on faith. No scene corroborates it, but Polonius's kindly attitude would not support the more sinister idea that he would have misappropriated them. Jean Simmons' Ophelia is too naive and childlike to keep anything from her parent. The BBC version provides another strong performance from Eric Porter as Polonius. His speech starts out practiced with formulas that show him to be just as much a sycophant as his own, Ronaldo. But he soon starts improvising amendments, distractedly opening parentheses and making jokes to cover an uncomfortable awkwardness.
Pepin, I have a daughter. Have while she is mine.
Now, this may well be due to Gertrude's reaction to his calling Hamlet mad. The word immediately gets her dander up, and he tries to quickly explain why he used that word. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern continually do this as a double act. Polonius does it for himself. The queen's ire no doubt motivates her first line.
More matter with less art.
And at that point, Claudius takes her hand to pacify her, though he soon loses his smile as well due to Polonius's trademark tediousness. Polonius reads the letter as if for the first time, or if not, at least picking up on key words for the first time. Beautified becomes a vile phrase only here. He's not prejudged the words. And he covers up any post-bosom awkwardness with an etc., as per the text, of course. The word machine makes him stop and hesitate, as if not expecting it, nor really understanding the turn of phrase. There is a slight cut before Polonius offers to have his head cut off. He no longer asks if he's ever been wrong before, and so Claudius no longer responds with ambivalence. Nothing major, though we do lose a small touch of irony on a point that's already well made. Despite the cuts Zeffirelli has made, I must admit Ian Holm's performance as Polonius is a lot of fun. He catches the royal couple in an open yard and takes them aside in a hurry, out of breath, fidgeting and stammering through a brisk walk and talk. Quite comical. His big revelation is that Hamlet is mad. By following this with a proud pause, Holm accentuates the comedy. He's taken them aside for this? Gertrude's impatience becomes justified. All three characters look around in a paranoid fashion, so we have to wonder if the court doesn't yet know Hamlet's gone mad. Are they trying to keep it a secret? It would seem to be a smart thing to do, but Hamlet, of course, won't make it very easy. Holm is very distracted, delighting in where his mind takes him while Gertrude stares into the air, bored and frustrated. He gets her attention again when he takes out the letter. She tries to look at it, but he moves away, looking for more light. He offers more comic pauses as he breaks from the letter to nostalgically think of his daughter.
Oh, I have a daughter. I have, while she is mine, who in her duty and obedience, Mark, hath given me this.
It's all quite hilarious. When he asks, what do you think of me? Gertrude's reaction is priceless. While Claudius humors him verbally, but when he's facing away from him, he rolls his eyes. This Polonius is more of a buffoon, and even his closest ally thinks him a fool. When he finishes with his thesis, they simply walk away, and he has to run in front of them to get their answer. This is when Claudius asks him for more evidence. Other versions played the scene as if Claudius wanted to hedge his bets or actively pursue Polonius's theory. Here we have an unbelieving Claudius who asks for more evidence. The text can definitely be read that way. Though Zeffirelli's Claudius is more plainly evil than others, it is his Polonius that keeps him on the path of malfeasance. If Polonius must egg Claudius on, it's because the king has stopped plotting. He's content with his winnings. The tragedy may not have resolved itself had not the foolish old man continued to meddle. The scene is fairly intact, for Zeffirelli anyway, but does omit the explanation as to why Ophelia should lock herself from Hamlet's presence. It is stated elsewhere, but the royals just take for granted that Polonius required this of her. It's a minor cut, but it scans strangely. From Act 2 onwards, Hamlet 2000 makes actually some big structural changes to the play. Scenes are rarely in the order we're used to. In this case, Polonius boards Hamlet reading before he goes to the king and queen. So he's seen the madness firsthand and is not getting his information from, well, his tight-lipped daughter, or any intercepted message, or Hamlet's public behavior. When he tells Gertrude her son is mad, well, there is surprise there from her. She wasn't aware of any problem, since in the modern setting, Hamlet often is outside of the Elsinore building, and she's been too wrapped up in her own happiness besides. There's also something to be said for both Hamlet and Ophelia already acting crazy, as modern youths are more likely to give in to their moods and eccentricities than those of the Elizabethan era. The scene is set at a pool on a high floor of the building, showing the opulence afforded these corporate royals, but also in keeping with Ophelia's thematic link to water. Polonius has brought her, and her rather outrageously baggy jeans, to this meeting with the royals. He's cocky and proud of himself, at times rehearsed, and often expecting reactions and getting none. Bill Murray's comic timing is impeccable here, leaving gaps for the other characters to respond when they don't have any lines.
A foolish figure, but farewell it, for I will use no art. Mad, let us grant him then.
Gertrude's impatience is evident, though she tends to hide it from Polonius by hiding behind her husband's back. Ophelia, for her part, is disaffected and numb through most of the exchange, having cut herself off from her emotions to bear the humiliation. Her father produces the letter he took from her at the start of the act, lying about her giving it to him voluntarily. He's bagged it as a piece of evidence. Ophelia reaches for it like a child whose toy has been taken away, but he keeps it from her. It happens again while he unenthusiastically reads it.
I have no art to reckon my groans. I love thee best, O most best. Never doubt I love thine evermore, whilst this machine is to him Hamlet.
And she just runs out of frame. This is all wonderfully comic, while also being tragic. The girl then starts walking along the pool's edge as if it were a tightrope. One irony of the play that is brought to light when directors include Ophelia in the scene is that while Hamlet may or may not have gone mad for love, Ophelia most definitely suffers for love, and no one realizes it. Hamlet remains the focus of the play, but it's Ophelia who takes her life and should have been on suicide watch. The idea of having her humiliated here makes the adults of the play complicit in driving her to it, and this Ophelia is literally on the edge. Apollonius walks towards camera before he asks what the royals think of him, hiding a smile indicating that, at least in his own mind, he's manipulating them. Not that he has an ulterior motive, but he does like it when he speaks to authority and it listens. This is an arrogant Apollonius. When he talks about Ophelia and Hamlet being a prince out of her star, he turns to her, chiding her for the second time. That's when she jumps into the water, foreshadowing her later drowning. This is just a fantasy, and we return to the scene. They never saw her jump, but for the audience, it's a sign of things to come. Ophelia has a deep desire to drown out the world around her. The dive muffles the sound of the dialogue. The scene cuts Claudius and Polonius' scheme, and only has Claudius give his counselor a look that makes him feel pressure to promise more detective work. In the Fodor version, Polonia's brevity speech is a seduction scene. As she makes her case, lacing her speech with false concern and furtive smiles, the tribal drums behind her voice turn to a driving dance beat. The lighting becomes more and more blown out, and the camera represents more and more the king's point of view. His head sways from side to side like a man hypnotized by a snake, and though they're discussing a serious matter, he smiles throughout the whole thing.
I hold my duty as I hold my soul, both to my God and to my gracious king. And I do think, or else this brain of mine hunts not the trail of policy so good as it used to do, that I have found the cause of Hamlet's lunacy.
Gertrude notices the effect Polonia has on her new husband, and after failing to dismiss the younger woman's words, she becomes more apprehensive. Lines cut from this section turn one in particular on its head. When Polonia says, "Your son is mad," the queen immediately throws out, "More matter with less art," giving it a sarcastic turn that attacks Polonia's bluntness and obviousness. Polonia ignores her, fixating on the king throughout, and continues with, "Mad, let us grant him then, since everyone agrees with her thesis." Gertrude loses ground quickly through this scene until we're well into the king's POV and her lines turn into a foreign language. I think German, I'm not sure. He no longer hears her, is the point. As Polonia reads her sister's letter, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern look at each other lasciviously. The ghost is still walking around. The characters in the play are much more exposed in this version, often present when Shakespeare dictated they should not be. As we get to the section's climax and Polonia's plot to spy on Hamlet and prove his madness, the dance beat goes up tempo and RNG turn into Polonia's backup band, and then it all cuts out. The lighting effect and music disappear as Hamlet and Horatio enter the room, breaking the spell. Awkwardness ensues. Now, from the very start, the tenet version's Gertrude finds Polonius tedious, rolling her eyes at his formulations. Claudius shares a secret smile with her, sympathizing, but finding humor in the counselor's natural disposition. Oliver Ford Davies continues to shine as a very distracted Polonius. For example, his attention starts to drift at time is time, as if lost in the line's philosophical implications. Keeping the control she had at the start of the scene, Gertrude snaps him out of his reverie by clearing her throat. So it's with embarrassment that he pledges brevity.
Why, day is day, night, night, and time is time. we're nothing but to waste night, day, and time. Therefore, since brevity is the soul of wit and tediousness the limbs and outward flourishes, I will be brief. Your noble son is mad.
Side note on the text. We've often talked about how time works strangely in the play, regarding Hamlet's age, for example, or how quickly the nights go by. So we have here, why day is day, night, night. Polonius's emphasis on time is time evokes that theme again. Shakespeare may be admitting that the timeline will not be explained or explainable. It would be a waste of time. He's deftly deflecting nitpicks regarding the apparent flaws in his story. Such is his power that he actually has us referring to symbolic time as a justification for those flaws. As he continues, the queen's reactions do nothing but terrorize him. He knows where he stands with the king, but not his lord's new relationship. It gives him a quick stammering delivery as he tries to disarm the queen with his words, over-explaining himself even as she requested he get to the point more quickly. He knows he's testing the queen's patience, but can't seem to find a way out. When he calls Hamlet mad, the queen's resounding and unscripted, ha, perhaps shows him that brevity has its own problems. His statement is insultingly obvious to her. Polonius calls for his daughter as he gets ready to read the letter she's given him, neatly stored in a portfolio. A servant brings in Ophelia. She basically stands there during what's left of the scene, more papers in her hands. This is because director Doran has chosen to follow the scene order from the so-called bad quarto that places the to-be-or-not-to-be speech and subsequent meeting between the former lovers right after this sequence. She needs to be ready. We'll later see how this affects our understanding of the play. For now, we're still on Polonius's dime.
To the celestial and my soul's idol, the most beautified Ophelia. Oh, that's an ill phrase. Vile phrase. Beautified is a vile phrase. But you shall hear. Thus, in her excellent white bosom, these, etc.
He reads the letter as if for the first time, stopping at bosom, surprised and embarrassed, skipping ahead with that comical etc. He keeps the paper away from the queen until he's finished reading. This is his time to shine. And there's a sense that he is competing with Gertrude for the king's attention. Though he has risen with his lord, he's still a peg too low in his opinion. Watch him in the background. When the queen says of his theory, it may be, he doesn't look vindicated. He frowns. Not understanding how she can doubt him, may rather than must. As for Ophelia's role in this sequence, there are some silent reactions to look for. When Gertrude hears about this young love, she looks at Ophelia as if for the first time. It seems the royals were not really aware of the relationship. And this makes sense, since Polonius himself had to wring it out of his daughter. So it must have been a fairly discreet affair. And when Gertrude agrees that Hamlet may be going mad for love, Ophelia smiles brightly. An odd reaction, perhaps, but Ophelia is focusing on the idea that Hamlet may love her rather than the madness. At that moment, she is accepted by the queen as a potential mate for Hamlet, and we find out later that, sincere or not, Gertrude would have liked to see them married. We will have to stay aware of this evolving relationship between the play's two female characters to see how we get from here to there. Let's now look at the original Classics Illustrated, in which Polonius actually is brief. The comic is so fixated on plot that it tries to often distill the drama to plot alone. The inexpressive figure work does not, in any case, have the subtlety required to make characters act. They just render heavily edited dialogue and walk off panel. It's very strange to read a brief Polonius. None of his usual digressions are present, not even his criticism of Hamlet's letter. He comes in, he tells the king and queen Hamlet is mad, and that a letter from his daughter might shed light on the matter. He reads it, the king agrees, while the queen says nothing, and Polonius unveils his plan to spy on the prince. In this cut-down version, the king asks Polonius, "Do you think tis this?" Not Gertrude. Since this is her first appearance in the comic, it doesn't fill one with hope that the character will amount to much. Act 2, Scene 2 is our first look at the king as well. The comic doesn't show the wedding banquet. And he is basically made to look like an evil wizard with a fat crown on his head, immediately sinister, but meanwhile the queen is a buxom, silent woman in light blue, apparently a clueless but guiltless pawn in the drama, showing more shoulder than character. In the Berkeley version, artist Tom Mandrake gives Polonius his due in watercolor, allowing the character to dominate the page. Though there are cuts to the text, his digressions remain, and the number of speech bubbles helps support the idea of his ironic lack of brevity. One major change from all other versions we've looked at is that Polonius recites Hamlet's letter by heart. He does not physically hold a letter in the scene. So what does this mean? Did Ophelia allow him to read it, but did not give it away? Is there no letter, per se? Just words Hamlet once told her and that she repeated to her father, and that he then repeats to the king and queen? The stage directions tell us Polonius reads, but the dialogue itself does not specify a letter. So this can just be the words, as words in Shakespeare are all-powerful. In a stage or film production where actors can be more expressive than drawings in a comic, which are trapped in a finite number of poses and expressions, this device could also be used to put Polonius's story into doubt. And as the word doubt comes up, you know, at the top of the letter, that's fitting. A sinister, manipulative Polonius could well be inventing or exaggerating the whole thing, and if so, could provide a disturbing portrait of a father talking about his daughter's bosom and so on. The king, for his part, looks bored in the comic throughout the exchange, I suspect more because he does not truly care about his stepson than he does about Polonius's pedantry. Hamlet arrives reading before the king and Polonius make plans to further try this. The king is less interested in dealing with Hamlet in this version, but he will be swept into the action more and more as Hamlet pushes him into a corner. Finally, and for the first time covering some Act 2 material, Johnny Hallyday's musical Hamlet is very much about Hamlet's point of view, and while we may hear the peasantry moan in the choir, there really aren't any songs to represent scenes in which Hamlet does not appear. So, while Hamlet does not appear in person in Polonius's big moment, he is present in the form of his letter to Ophelia. After all, it is his words we hear, butchered though they might be by the foolish Polonius. Hamlet is such a large character that he tends to be on stage even when he isn't. The letter is represented by a song, and that song is called Doot or Doubt. Let's listen.
Qu'une étoile morte puisse briller. Doute que la vérité ne soit vraie. Mais ne doute pas de mon amour.
Now in the song, we recognize Hamlet's poem immediately. doubt this and doubt that, but do not doubt my love. Halliday even translates actual elements from it. So there are translations of that the stars doth move, truth to be a liar. He also picks up lines from elsewhere in the play, such as Polonius's own doubt, which is in the chorus, springes to catch woodcocks, piège à bécasse here. So in the same song, Hamlet implores Ophelia not to doubt his love, even as the choir plays Polonius's doubts concerning Hamlet's true intentions, and maybe popular opinion or the audience's own doubts. While the chorus plays with a distinct animal theme, you got woodcocks, wolves in sheep's clothing, etc., Hamlet's sections are more nihilistic. The sun is a dead star, earth is a particle of dust, hell is invoked, and time is an enemy and not a friend. One line goes, "O doubt that a child live in a belly." The suggestion of pregnancy is an intriguing one. It makes us wonder if Halliday thought Ophelia might have been pregnant. There is talk later of breeding sinners, and Hamlet teases and tortures Polonius with the possibility of Ophelia conceiving. Is Ophelia's suicide also an abortion? This isn't something that's attempted in the various film versions, but the play hints at it in various ways. And yet it's the first time I've had cause to think of it. Of course, we're allowed to doubt this, so Halliday may be reacting to the suggestion, but doesn't give us a definitive answer, and neither did Shakespeare. It can also be interpreted as Hamlet's trademark nihilism, denying his own birth, just as he denies his own mother. And that ends our look at Act 2, Scene 2, Part 2. Next time, Scene 2 continues as Polonius boards a mad Hamlet. If you have thoughts on this particular episode, please head over to fireandwaterpodcast.com, leave them there. And if you like this content, think about visiting our Patreon page at patreon.com/FW podcast. Thanks for listening, and I hope, dear listener, you'll return for Act 2, Scene 2, Part 3, The Fishmonger Scene.